Welcome, everybody, to the March 9th meeting of the Senate Business Transportation Economic Development Committee. The first bill we're going to open a public hearing on is Senate Bill 160. Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 160 creates offense of driver operation when riding with an animal on an operator's lap. Punishes by a maximum of $90 fine. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. We've also received written testimony on this bill already, for the record, but from Craig Campbell of AAA in support of the measure, and from the Oregon Humane Society in support of the measure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Bauer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jennifer Lewis. I'm Senator Burdick's Chief of Staff, and I'm here today to talk about Senate Bill 160. Senate Bill 160 is a simple bill seeking to address one potential problem that causes careless or distracted driving in Oregon. According to ODOT, between 2006 and 2009, 31 people in Oregon were killed in crashes caused by careless driving. During that same time, 5,370 people were injured in crashes caused by careless driving. Careless driving can be dangerous both to the individuals inside the car and to those surrounding the vehicle on the road. Senate Bill 160 creates an offense of driving with a pet in your lap and designates that offense as a Class D traffic violation with a maximum fine of $90. Driver distraction is a serious issue on our roads. Pets are unpredictable when they're in the car and can be a serious cause of distraction. Even the most well-behaved animal may react to sudden movement or sound. It is simply dangerous for the driver and for the animal and for the cars around that vehicle to have an animal on the driver's lap. In our district, Senate District 18, we had a recent example of a driver who was distracted by a dog in her car, and she pressed the accelerator rather than the brake. She hit a bicyclist, severely injuring that bicyclist, and proceeded to run into the side of a house. I believe that both the Oregon Humane Society and AAA have introduced testimony in support of the bill, and I have asked Christina Settler, who's known as the pet safety lady across the nation, to discuss pet safety with you, and I'm happy to answer any questions now or later about Senate Bill 160, and I encourage your support.
Questions? Don't see any. Want to introduce your guest on the phone? Is it?
I think Christina will give a background of who she is and what work she does. But she's known as the Pet Safety Lady, and her mission in this nonprofit is to help people keep their animals safer in travel, whether that's vehicle travel or flight, whatever that might be. So she's done some great work on this issue and has some comments for the committee.
Okay.
That's one question.
Senator Girard.
I promised to be nice, so. The question is, you said that the Humane Society was for it. Is that the Oregon Humane Society or the Humane Society of the United States?
It was the Oregon Humane Society.
You might get my vote.
Thank you, Senator.
Is it Christine?
Christina, you're on the phone?
Yes.
It's all yours.
Chair Byers. And the members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christina Selter, and I am the founder of Bark Buckle Up. And there's a screen up there with my company name right on there. We're basically the recognized leaders and pet travel safety experts. We work with police and fire agencies nationwide, Department of Transportation, and NHTSA, getting the information out to the public. We do not make or sell products. It's all legitimate statistics that are collected and given back to the different agencies. So we're going to go to slide 2, and you can read this in detail later. Basically, this goes through what Bark Buckle Up is, what we do, that we don't sell or endorse or make products. We are strictly about the education and the statistics that we create and collect and then report back. Now, as she mentioned, I am referred to by these agencies as Pet Safety Lady. I'm the only person in the nation, actually in the world, that has buckled up more than 10,000 pets in a vehicle, secured more than 3,000 pets in life vests, a lot down in Florida. I'm a female automotive expert, and I'm the only woman certified with NHTSA as a VIN verification for a new U.S. car manufacturer. And then there's some statistics in there for pets. Basically, 70 million homes have a pet. More than half of those have more than one pet. And traveling with your pet in vehicles is at 82%, but that has gone up 300% since 2005. Now, the things that created that or made it go up was because of lodging at hotels, So you're going from A to B to C. Of course, you're going in a car to go on vacation. Now the airlines have announced a major increase over the past few years of which ones allow pets in cabin and as cargo. So now people are taking more pets to the airports, which is creating major safety issues for first responders. We support first responders because their job is when they get to the scene of an accident or an emergency, they are to get human occupants to safety. If there's a frightened or scared or injured pet in the vehicle, they will hover over the driver and not allow the first responders access to the human occupants in the car to get them to safety. So things are delayed. If it's during traffic hour, Humane Society or the other agencies cannot even get to the accident quickly to remove the pet, and that sometimes these pets are either killed or they have to be put down at the scene of the accident. So now you've got people even more upset at an emergency situation, or the pet escapes, runs into traffic, and causes cars or big rigs to swerve and causes another accident. Now we are on slide 3. Basically, these are our top key points of why a pet does not belong on your lap. Just like a child, it causes driver distraction, and we all know driver distraction kills. Whether you have a pet on your lap, a child, you're eating, drinking, or shaving, all of these things are taking your attention and your eyes off the road, which causes accidents and kills. Pets on your lap as a distraction, but also the airbag is a major danger, not just to you with a pet on your lap, but that pet, that small 5-10 pound pet, their rib cage, with such force coming from the airbag, can be embedded into your rib cage. Now our first responders are having to deal with that live at an accident. The distraction, if the pet gets out, they're chasing them all over the road, which happens a lot. And then, of course, the delay for rescue workers to get to the human occupants. If you have your children in the car or other passengers, it's your responsibility to be a good driver and to pay attention to the road. And if you're talking or looking at your pet or petting them or trying to get them to calm down, you're not paying attention to the road, which causes accidents. Projectile, whether the pet's on your lap or just next to you, or you set them next to you on that other seat, he can become a projectile. A 20-pound pet, so one of those little fluffy dogs on your lap, you have an accident at only 35 miles per hour. So that's neighborhood driving. That pet becomes a projectile force of over 1,000 pounds rocketing through that vehicle or through a windshield. First responders, again, have to clean up the mess. They have to calm everybody down. They have to have a removal of the pet. It could be during rush traffic. And, of course, other accidents, looky-loos, people trying to figure out what's going on or where the pet is if he's running around. So it's just best to not have a pet, child, or anything on your lap that distracts you from not looking at the road and driving your vehicle. And as Jennifer mentioned earlier on the next screen, Oregon just had a report from the police agency that the driver was distracted by her dog and she hit a cyclist. If she had been going faster, she probably would have killed the cyclist. Just like the young man in Connecticut last year who was driving down the highway with his dog on his lap, the dog licked him, he turned his head for a second to push the dog away, veered across the highway at 65 miles an hour and hit an oncoming car, and later that driver died. The dog died, the car is totaled, and that young man at 20-some years old served time and paid his fine and now has to live with the fact that because he was petting his dog, he killed somebody. So there's a few samples there. You can read through each of them. There's some links. We actually put a list here of some first responder agencies that we've worked with for the past 5-7 years. Commissioner of California Highway Patrol is a big supporter of ours, Department of Transportation, NHTSA, Highway Patrol in Nevada, New York State Police, Wyoming, MAD, Orange County Sheriff's Department. They all support the message. We don't go out and tell people what they should use or what they should not use in keeping their pets off their lap, whether they buckle them or don't buckle them. But the pet does not belong on the lap in the front seat, distracting the driver and taking his eyes off the road. Our stat tracker program that we created for police and fire chiefs nationwide, we are going to communicate with the Oregon State Police to start collecting the data and statistics for your area over the next 5 years. Right now on a police report for an accident or a ticket, there is nothing on there that allows them to check a box or tell you if the pet was on the lap and caused an accident. Basically, that is the responsibility of the officer to put in the comment section What the stat tracker does is works with that individual agency to collect the statistics and data and then feeds it back to them in reporting through the stat tracker program. It's all free, and we do it with the agencies nationwide so that they can get a better handle on how much it's increased in their specific area with pets riding on the lap or causing accidents or being injured in an accident. And the only way they can improve their laws and legislation is to start collecting the statistics and data and reporting it back. And we are willing to work with them and get this information back to Senator Burdick's office over the next 5 years, and then she can get it back to the Business, Transportation, and Economic Development Committee, which is yourself. And there you have it.
Thank you. Are there questions? Guess there are no questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I have one other person signed up to testify. Great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA in support of Senate Bill 160. In general, AAA is supportive of legislation that reduces the likelihood of distracted driving by a motorist. Recently, AAA did a national study on the amount of use of dogs or other animals within a vehicle. They found that of those who own dogs, about 60% bring them with them when they go to various locations within their car. Of those, about one-fifth of them put them on their laps. And as a kind of a twofold interest for AAA in supporting the bill, the first is that when you have any non-secured item within a vehicle, it acts essentially as a velocity-driven object during a crash, and that poses a risk to those who are in the vehicle, not to mention the pet in this particular instance. This is compounded when you have the person in the front seat with the driver, where not only is the pet at risk of serious injury or death, much like a child in the front seat as a result of the deployment of the driver's side airbag, but it also prevents that driver's side airbag from deploying properly in an accident, thus putting the driver at further risk. Not to mention the distracted nature of having the animal in your lap while you're driving. That poses a further risk to those around the vehicle. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it, but I did want to share with you the results of the study that we had nationally and the fact that AAA supports the bill that you have before you. I know you have a lot of other work, but I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? Seeing none? Let's see, that's the last I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 160, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 341.
Richard. Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 341 relates to motor vehicles and has to do with brake pads, and there is an amendment that replaces the measure that creates an offense for passing or driving alongside of a motor vehicle in a roundabout. It allows a commercial motor vehicle to operate in more than one lane in a multi-lane roundabout when it is not practical to remain entirely in one lane, and it requires signage at multi-lane roundabouts regarding the hazard of driving next to commercial vehicles. There, we do not have a revenue or a fiscal on the original bill, but we do have statements on both for the Dash 2 amendments, and there's minimal expenditure impact and no revenue impact.
Chair Barr, this is a gut and stuff, is it not?
This is a gut and stuff.
Thank you.
Proposal. Oda. Show and tell day.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I'm trying to get a video up here to demonstrate what this bill does. While we're working on that, I'll start my testimony. The Senate Bill 341 with the dash 2 amendments makes overtaking, passing, or driving alongside a commercial motor vehicle in a roundabout a traffic offense. Oregon law defines a commercial vehicle as a motor vehicle or a combination of motor vehicles that has a weight of 26,000 pounds or more. One is designed to transport 16 or more vehicles or any size vehicle that transports hazardous material. A commercial motor vehicle does not include fire trucks or emergency vehicles or recreational vehicles. As many of us have driven around Oregon the last few years, we've noticed the increase in the amount of roundabouts that we have in the state. The vast majority of those are single-lane roundabouts and are relatively simple to negotiate. We've seen those on relatively low-volume city streets and have worked quite effectively as we've learned to apply those in the appropriate settings. Always looking for additional tools to add to our toolbox for designing intersections and to deal with safety issues at those intersections. We've also begun to apply multi-lane roundabouts. And today we have 7 different multi-lane roundabouts in Oregon, one of those on the state highway system. One of the things, as you can see in the video, that happens in those multi-lane roundabouts when large commercial vehicles enter the roundabout, they need to negotiate those roundabouts by using both lanes. What we're proposing in the House Bill 341 with the dash 2 amendments is to make it illegal to pass or overtake or drive alongside of a commercial motor vehicle in multi-lane roundabouts, and would address the conflicts that are shown here in the video. We're also committing to do an educational program to educate motorists about this issue and about the new law if it were to pass, and also to install signs as motorists enter those roundabouts to inform them of the new situation. So in summary, we're dealing with those operational issues that come up with new things that implemented, like multi-lane roundabouts, and this is a solution to large commercial vehicles and multi-lane roundabouts.
Questions of Paul? Senator Starr?
Thank you. Thank you. What's the new fascination with roundabouts about?
They're a new way to efficiently move traffic, again, in the right circumstances where you don't have traffic signals. I think one of the misconceptions a lot of people have with traffic signals is they automatically make an intersection safer. Usually what you do with a traffic signal, you're trading off one type of accidents for another. Typically when we put traffic signals in, we actually see an increase in accidents, but what we do see is the severity of those accidents go down significantly. And so you're trading off maybe a few very serious accidents for more numerous, less serious fender benders that are there. One of the things that roundabouts offer is another solution to that, where we may be able to reduce accidents even further than what we do with traffic signal and move traffic through in a more efficient manner. Again, that depends very specific on specific intersections, and you've got to look at the balance of traffic, the type of traffic, and the particulars of the situation you're in to apply those. And I would say as a state, we're still in the learning curve of where to apply those. Personally, I've seen those applied most effectively on city streets for the most part in Oregon, but nationwide they're showing up in a number of different places on state highways, on the interstate system, off ramps, many different places.
Follow up. Are we looking at comparable costs, less expensive than maintaining a signalized intersection interchange?
Chair Beyer, Senator Starr. Again, that varies. What you'll see with roundabouts is they take considerably more right-of-way in heavily urbanized areas where you have to buy very expensive right-of-way. They'll be more expensive. So again, it depends situation by situation. I would say in general, again, applying these in urban situations, they're probably initially more expensive, but you don't have the long-term maintenance costs that you do with traffic signals.
Just to follow up and a comment, where I live, they're not done in urban areas, they're done in rural areas. I've had roundabouts and on rural throughways, found them to be very, very efficient moving people. The new one is going in on River Road, Shoals Ferry Road, and Highway 219, I think that is, which is interesting, but mm-hmm. I personally like roundabouts. I think that they are safer than a signal. So I appreciate you bringing the bill.
Good. I would add, Senator Starr, that we have one in Springfield that's very much like the one that was on the screen there, and I was skeptical about it, but it actually works very well. I'm not sure that it makes a lot of sense to put those in large highway situations where you have a lot of commercial traffic, but my understanding is that ODOT has put a hiatus on that until the traffic safety study is done.
Mr. Chair, we have. And I think that's part of this learning curve I'm talking about implying roundabouts, that we need to learn more in these heavy freight corridors of how to apply and design roundabouts. We're involved in a multi-state study to learn more about how to apply design standards in ways that can accommodate commercial vehicles. In those areas where we can accommodate commercial vehicles, don't apply the roundabout tool.
Other questions or comments? Senator Girard?
Well, since everybody's thrown out comments, I probably differ a little bit, and that is, it seems to me like the roundabouts, if it's a single lane, works pretty good. The multi-lane, and Europe has multi-lane roundabouts, and every time I've been in them, they're kind of a disaster. So I like the single lane roundabouts. This deals with multi-lane roundabouts. I'll still vote for it because I think if you're going to have them, I think you need truck safety is imperative. But I would like to see the studies on how that improves things over a stoplight.
Senator Starr.
Just a comment to Senator Rudd. So how many times did you go around the Arc de Triomphe before?
Oh, no, you were with Senator Rudd.
There was some international gestures being done.
I'm assuming we're done. Never this one. Thank you, Paul. Bob Russell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell. I'm with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and my members support this bill, although we continue to have reservations about multi-lane roundabouts. Single-lane roundabouts don't represent the issue to us, but as you could see from the illustration, when it's in a multi-lane situation, we cannot hold our lane. And often we find that there are cars on the inside, and we end up with a little fender bender, and that becomes very expensive for everybody. We very much appreciate the department having a moratorium on roundabouts on state highways until we can finish the multi-state study and learn more about them and how they should be designed to accommodate commercial vehicles. As far as roundabouts in urban areas, we don't have near the problem with those as long as they're not on freight routes. And there's a way that we can, a detour around them. Where we really get Twitter-pated, for lack of a better term, is out in the boondocks, where there are no alternatives to the state highway, and we're forced to use a roundabout. So we think that ODOT's taking the right path. They're going to learn some more, and we're going to have some more discussions before we go forward with any more roundabouts. And this bill, in fact, will make it better. So we do support it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any questions, Mr. Russell? Seeing none, you're off the hook this time. That was all I had signed up to testify on this bill. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 341, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 341. As Senator Girard mentioned earlier, we are replacing the main bill with the Dash 2 amendments, so the chair moves the Dash 2 amendment. Is there discussion on the Dash 2s? Is there any opposition to the Dash 2s? The Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 341 are adopted. The bill is amended. It is now in front of us. The chair moves Senate Bill 341 as amended by the Dash 2s to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? No discussion. Is there any opposition? Senate Bill 341 as amended is moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation. We will now open a public hearing on the carrier. On that will be Senator Starr. Would you like to carry that? Senator Starr. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 523.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 523 allows notification to occur by first-class mail with proof of mailing for intention to recover storage expenses for to be foreclosed on personal property. It removes provisions that the contents of a vehicle are not subject to a lien if found in an abandoned vehicle taken from public property if the contents are claimed in the first 15 days of custody. It excludes personal property of an emergency nature, such as prescription medication or identification, from being subject to a lien if found in an abandoned vehicle if claimed in the first 15 days of custody. Permits a vehicle valued at under $500 to be sold to an individual who does not have a valid dismantler certificate. There's no revenue impact and minimal expenditure impact on this measure. I've received two amendments, dash one and dash two amendments, and I have not yet received any word on fiscal or revenue on these amendments. We also have testimony, pre-submitted testimony from Michael Wilson from the Automotive Recyclers Association, who is in support of the amendments but not the bill.
Okay. And let's see here. What did I just do with that? First signed up is Mr. Elkins, Porter and Wagner. Mr. Elkins.
Thank
welcome.
You. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like you to know, first of all, that yesterday at about noon, my phone started ringing and my fax machine started going and my computer started doing its email thing, and I got a number of people that wanted to talk to us about this bill. So today at noon in the rotunda, we met with the sheriff's representatives, the city of Portland, insurance industry representatives, and spokespeople for the homeless, and we gathered all their concerns about the bill. We have, and we will continue working with them on the bill. We have a summary sheet that we'll go over with you about the original bill and talk to you about the bill and walk you through it and the amendments, but I want you to know that we will be working with these folks during this process. Okay. With me today is Michael Porter from Speeds Towing and Mike Wagner from Sandy Am Enterprises and Towing in Lyons, Oregon, and Mike is going to take us through this sheet and tell you a section-by-section analysis of what the bill does.
And Mr. Chairman and Committee, my name is Mike Porter, and to just go through the section here. Section 1 is, it basically creates a consistency in the lien process. At this point in time, there's a Chapter 819, 87, and 98. Everything refers to Chapter 87, so we're just moving it all into one chapter so that it's a little bit easier to understand and save DMV having to process three different forms of paperwork. Section 2 is adding with proof of mailing. It reduces the cost of notification for currently over $4 for certified mail to under $2. There's a couple reasons for this. One, it saves cost for the tower, but also there are many people who won't accept a certified letter, and if we send it certified, they actually will take the mail so that they know that we have their vehicle. Number 3 is one that we have talked to, that is many towers serve multiple counties, yet hold one public auction for the sale of unclaimed vehicles. We wanted to add an adjacent county to allow towers to legally sell the vehicle. If you turn it over to Section 18, we've changed that a bit so that the vehicle is held for a longer period of time before they move it. Section 4, lump the under 500 value cars with the $1,000 car value. At this point in time, if you value a car under $500, the lien process is shorter and only can be sold to a certified wrecker. We had put in this that we wanted that changed. That is also a section that we're in discussions with. Section 5 and 6 are just a language cleanup. Section 7 adds specific language to RS 897.26, clearly requiring the registered owner responsible for the bill not covered by the sale of vehicle. We call it efficient balance. If you don't know, many of the vehicles that we tow are end up costing the tour quite a bit of money once you figure in storage in the towing. That's also a section that is being discussed. Let's see here. Section 9 and 10, the language cleanup. Section 12 clarifies which personal property that may be removed from the tow vehicle while in storage. That, again, is a section that we're working with different folks on right now. Section 13 creates another place that holds the registered owner responsible for charges, cost to dispose of abandoned or unclaimed vehicle. Section 14 saves the agency over $3 per notification by using a proof of mailing other than certified mail. That extends notification from time from 48 hours to 3 business days. And 15 and 16 are just language cleanups. We referred to 18 earlier. If a lien debtor has not reclaimed a vehicle that's been towed, the vehicle has been in storage for 15 days. The lien claimant may move the vehicle to an adjacent county for public auction. And Section 20, if a county does not have a tower that can tow a 2600 GVW vehicle, that allows the tour for adjacent county to remove the said vehicle and return it to its home adjacent county. Basically meaning not every county has a tower that can tow a semi, a large vehicle. This allows them to tow the vehicle in the county, bring it to their county, and hold their auction there. At this point in time, they can't do that.
I will work with Mr. Chair Al Elkins again. I will work and keep staff updated on where we are in the process of working with the other groups.
Okay. Anybody else?
You're just here to be alone. Okay. Any questions? Senator Stark.
Thank you. The dash two amendments are your amendments, is that correct?
The dash two are, yes.
And the dash ones?
I have not seen the dash ones. I called staff earlier this morning and there were no dash ones, so I have not seen them as of yet.
We have a copy, so you can get it after the hearing.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's see. Monica Dorco. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Monica Goracki, and I'm an attorney with the Oregon Law Center. As you may know, the Oregon Law Center's mission is to achieve access to justice for vulnerable, low-income Oregonians and their communities. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon about Senate Bill 523. My office serves the 10 counties of Northwest Oregon. I've represented and spoken to many homeless individuals about the legal and social problems they face. Many homeless men and women have recently escaped domestic violence, are elderly, or have physical or mental disabilities. In the Portland area, about 1,600 homeless people sleep outside every night because they can't afford housing and the shelters are full. A lot of people live doubled or tripled up with other households in motel rooms or in their cars. And the situation is similar across Oregon. The long waiting list for shelter and low-income housing in Portland and the lack of shelters and housing in rural communities mean that many people sleep in their vehicles while waiting for help. Their car is the only thing standing between them and total destitution. It's a shelter from the weather. It's the place they keep everything they own. I want to share a story with you of a couple who contacted me for help a few weeks ago. I'm going to just call them Kathy and Steve. They're homeless. They were sleeping in their van because they had nowhere else to go. The van was parked on a public street with expired registration. It was impounded and towed. Kathy and Steve were allowed to take only a blanket and whatever else they could carry. They're now sleeping under a bridge. Most of us in this room are probably fortunate enough to view a towed vehicle as nothing more than an inconvenience. But I would like to ask you to imagine yourselves in Kathy and Steve's shoes for a minute. A tow truck has just driven away with your home and almost everything you own. You're standing on the sidewalk. Your immediate problem is how to stay warm through the night, how to keep from getting robbed, how to get to court, pay the fine, get your van back. A couple days later, you call the tow company and you're told that A lien has attached immediately to all contents of the van except a few items of an emergency nature. You try to explain to the person on the phone that everything you own is in the van and you can't replace any of it, that this is an emergency, but she says there's nothing she can do. The reality is that even 15 days is not long enough for many homeless people to scrape together enough money to pay towing fines and storage fees to get their vehicles back. Removing this waiting period will directly cause an increase in homelessness. Giving towers the right to sell a vehicle that is appraised at less than $500 with no right to a hearing for the vehicle's owner will have the same result. Many of the vehicles that poor people own and may live in would be appraised at very low value. I've seen over and over that when poor people have their vehicles towed, they are thrown into even more dire straits than before. They have no way to replace what is lost. They are emotionally and physically bereft. The psychic cost of this catastrophe is enough to send people into depression and a downward spiral. Their homelessness becomes even more difficult to escape, and the community bears the resulting costs of their inability to care for themselves. This is the wrong time to make a legislative change that will have a devastating effect on Oregonians who are forced to sleep and store their possessions in their vehicles. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none. Are you Mark?
I am. Yes. Senator Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Mark Jolin. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit based in Portland called Join. We work specifically with people who are sleeping outside or in their vehicles. Our mission is to help them get back into permanent housing. We do that in cooperation with the local public safety community and the local business community. And this issue of folks living in their vehicles and the consequences of towing that Monica just raised is something that we confront quite a bit. As you know, Oregon's got one of the highest rates of homelessness in the country. The recession has made that situation all that much worse. Many folks who become homeless start out by couch surfing, sleeping with friends or family, but when that's not an option, they're most often going to initially move themselves and their belongings into a vehicle, an RV or a car. Unfortunately, their poverty often dictates that they're unable to keep the expenses of vehicle ownership up. And because of ordinances that limit people's ability to live in their cars, they're often finding those vehicles towed after a matter of time. And when those vehicles are towed, the most important things, the most important possessions in their lives go with them. Currently, under the statute, when the police initiate a tow from public property, a lien attaches to the vehicle, but not to the contents of that vehicle, the personal property in that vehicle, for 15 days. For homeless people, that protection is absolutely critical. Whether it's the tools they use for work, their family photo albums, their pillows and sleeping bags, these belongings are important. Important to their survival, their ability to rebuild their lives, and important to their sense of identity. In many cases, a homeless family or individual will not have the resources to get their vehicle out of tow. They can't cover the expenses. But because of the lien limitation, they at least have the opportunity and the right to get their personal items out of the vehicle. This bill would remove that protection, limiting what a person could retrieve to emergency items, which are defined as includes but not limited to prescription medication, eyeglasses, clothing, identification, a wallet, a purse, a credit card, a checkbook, cash, child car seat, and booster seats. That exception just isn't broad enough. I think of a woman and a man as I was writing this this morning who are living with their two girls in an RV. And basically in that RV are their kids' favorite toys, their books, their bicycles. The parents do have emergency items in that RV for sure. But they've also got letters and correspondence. They've got their family mementos. They've got a variety of electronics. It's not a lot, but it's what they have. And around the state, there are hundreds of families and individuals every night who are in that same situation, living in their vehicles. And when those vehicles are towed, if they can't get their possessions out, it's devastating. So I would just ask, and I really appreciate that the representatives of the tow industry who just testified said that they were open to working with us on some of these types of issues, that this bill not go forward until this particular issue has been addressed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much, both of you. That is all I have signed up to testify on Senate Bill 523. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we will, since Mr. Elkins, you're still working on this one, we'll let her go close the hearing and let you let me know when you're ready to move forward.
Thank you, sir.
So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 523, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 537. Richard?
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 537 permits a local government to authorize, limit, or impose conditions on growth at airports when growth is related to basing additional helicopters. There's no revenue and no expenditure impact on this, and we have already had a hearing on this on March 7th.
Okay, thank you. I've got four people signed up, so Elaine Saunders, David Bratton, and Curry Richter. Not sure, and then I guess I got more than that. And then Washington County after that. Whoever wants to go first.
Hi, I'll go first. My name is Ellen Saunders. This is testimony on Senate Bill 537. Good afternoon, Chairman Byers and committee members. I live at 47950 Northwest Dingheiser Road in Manning, Oregon. I'm here to support Senate Bill 537. The new rule would allow the community and the counties to assess the impacts of added helicopter flights and make decision based on the needs of the entire community rather than just one commercial aviator who might not be fully understanding of the already established activities of the community. For example, Mr. Appleby did not submit an application for expansion plans or consult with the community until neighbors complained so vigorously that he was forced to follow Washington County procedures and hold a neighborhood meeting. The substantial expansion of Apple Valley Airport required filing plans and having them approved. Mr. Appleby did none of that till after he put up an illegal sign advertising flight training and sightseeing at Apple Valley. The rules regulating the flight of helicopter is see and avoid. This is very different from the designated flight path of fixed-wing airplanes. The noise level is also very different. Apple Valley Airport was originally a grass airstrip used only by a few small airplanes. The noise plumes were limited and infrequent. When Mr. Appleby began to fly helicopters, including very loud Huey helicopters, the sound plume echoed so loudly in the narrow valleys that it rattled windows and made conversation outdoor impossible. There was no protection from the noise as he was flying low and in circles over our homes with his flight training activities. This activity was not permitted, but he continued. In the past 6 years, we have won two LUBA appeals that limit the activity on Apple Valley to agricultural only. Yet we see evidence of flight training regularly. He also keeps several small training helicopters in the hangar, lending credence to our observations of 1 hour time illegal flight trainings that include hovering. Our area is home to many people who own farm animals, including horses. The linear trail from Banks to Vernonia goes right past Apple Valley Airport. The trail facilities and the L.L. Stubbs Stewart State Park, through which the trail travels, are intended for use by equestrians. They are put in danger from sudden loud noises. The neighboring Banks Christian Academy is only blocks away from Apple Valley. The noise substantially diminishes the students' concentration. The entire airport is in a low-lying floodplain area that drains into Dairy Creek. Dairy Creek is an important water source for local farmers and wildlife. Pollution is a serious concern. The small corrections suggested to the original Airport Protection Act in no way interfere with the expansion of aviation in suitable areas. These small changes will only allow the land use issues to be reviewed by the counties and the residents that are affected. The value of property adjacent to loud noise plumes is substantially decreased. The type of use sustainable on property near small airstrips is substantially changed when there are large expansions. citizens. It is only reasonable to allow citizens to participate in the decisions that permanently affect the quality of their land. If they are not considered in land use decisions, it becomes a taking of their land. For the above stated reasons and many more, I am asking you to vote yes on Senate Bill 537 to allow counties and their residents to participate in the land use changes that affect them. There are a group of us that are here, and we are very interested in this issue. I'm here to answer any questions you might have or to go on to the other testimony.
Questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Senator Beyer, committee members, my name is David Bratton. I am a co-chair of NAVE along with Ellen Saunders here. The brochure that you have shows some of the outline of what we've been through over the last 5 years in our defense of our homes and properties that are adjacent to this expanding airstrip. 537 would be a very good tool in the box for the counties to not have to go through the protracted process that we went through. It was very, very time consuming and very expensive, not only for us as the citizens of this area, but also I would imagine that Mr. Gilmore from Washington County could also attest to the amount of money that Washington County exerted and expended upon going through these two processes. So I too am here to urge you to support this. This would be a benefit to all parties involved. It would be clarification or additional clarifying tool in these expansion processes, and we look for your support.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, committee members. I'm Carrie Richter, an attorney representing NAVE. I'd like to quickly respond to a number of comments that were raised at the last hearing and answer any other questions you may have. First of all, I'd like to note that this amendment will have no effect on existing helicopter operations such as Columbia and Evergreen helicopters. Existing helicopter operation may continue on land at all private airports. Senate Bill 537 would only allow local governments the power to review their growth in the future should they elect to do so. Senate Bill 537 does not add any substantive limitation on the expansion of private airports to include helicopters. Rather, it allows those local governments who elect to require additional review to establish an appropriate balance of the impacts versus the benefits on their own. In other words, if the city of Aurora or Clackamas County wanted to allow the growth of the Aurora Airport, they could do so freely, and this bill would have no impact. The suggestion has been made that Washington County is trying to change the rules and alter the expectations. My clients have mentioned how long, since 2007, they have been working to try to limit growth of the Apple Valley Airport, and both times they've succeeded. The owner of Apple Valley Airport came the first time and tried to add new uses, and we were able to limit those new uses in the first go-around. Second time, they're trying to expand the airport beyond the overlay boundaries, and again, Luba said, you can't do that. And I think this also suggests another thing, that the Airport Protection Act is not entirely as clear as one might think it is. On one hand, the Airport Protection Act does not allow unfettered authorization for aviation on private-use airports. It's much more specific. It allows for the continued growth and continuation and growth of uses that existed during 1996, and for uses that were approved by a local government prior to January 1, 1997. In other words, there's a suggestion that what was existing in 1996 could keep going and grow. And the uses are very specific in the statute. They talk about flight instruction, crop dusting, firefighting, recreation activities, sporting activities. They're very specific, limited uses. On the other hand, this same provision prohibits any limitation on certain uses. For example, basing additional aircraft and increases in flight activity shall be permitted. That it's that ambiguity that Luba mentioned in 2007 makes the Airport Protection Act a lack of clarity. And this is why we think we need to clarify it by saying you can grow unlimited aircraft, but that's fixed-wing aircraft and not helicopters. The legislative history of this provision suggests that it was intended to allow those uses in place, such as agricultural, forest, firefighting activities, to continue and grow that existed in 1996-97, but does not allow unregulated new uses, such as commercial tourist or recreational helicopter activities, to grow. The legislative history is silent on helicopters. Given the dearth of legislative intent to suggest that including unregulated growth without review was intended when first implemented, we ask that you agree to limit the Airport Planning Act when it comes to helicopters and approve Senate Bill 537. And I have reviewed the Dash 1 amendments, and that would resolve our concern about making it retroactive to the first of the year. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Washington County, Jim.
For the record, Chair Beyer, committee members, Jim McCauley, representing Washington County. You're being handed out the county's testimony today, as well as Dash 1 amendments. And those amendments, plainly put, are just retroactive to January 1 of 2011. Wanted to make some comments here, I think based on a little bit of time away from the last hearing, a little bit more consultation with County Council, as well as some conversations with Aviation Department. I think the heart of Oregon's Airport Planning Act was to establish protections for existing airports, and we believe that nothing in Senate Bill 537 does anything to undo those protections. With 537 in place, existing airport operators will continue to utilize their facilities and aircraft that are in place, including helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft currently based at that facility. We aren't trying to scale back any of those protections in this bill, and no impact on the ability to fully utilize the existing investments on the ground we believe are going to be impacted. What does change with Senate Bill 537 is a process for approving a future expansion of airports when helicopters are physically added to that site. Nothing in this bill is going to impact the addition of airplanes. We believe that the change in process for operators that add new helicopters by adding this public input process to the application process is actually going to be a benefit to them, in addition to, of course, the public input that we currently can't provide for at this time. With a permit and permitting process, neighbors, operators, and local government can utilize the written permit as a vehicle for problem solving. Because of our charge for developing clear and objective standards, the permit will provide certainty with regard to operations and long-term business improvements. It provides a reasonable means of addressing impacts to deal with neighbor concerns, and it provides a clear written decision to address ongoing complaints, something that we don't currently have in place when our helicopters are added to some of these existing facilities. So we believe there is benefit beyond just the public input process. I think it's important in terms of context as you review this bill that the discretion of local jurisdiction in this bill is limited. We as a county are only going to be able to impose something that is clear and objective in terms of conditions. This means operators can make prudent business investments based on those clear conditions without the uncertainty of running into a nuisance or an enforcement issue. The approval standards that we're talking about for adding helicopters set a high bar for neighbors and local government. Additional helicopters are allowed unless they seriously interfere with existing land use activities, so it's not a standard of no impacts. It's something well beyond just simply seeing a helicopter out there. And we're confident that this high standard and the permitting process actually favors applicants for moving through this process because of the clear and objective basis for it. I think we can appreciate at the end of this process that we still have some concerns out there. But again, I believe on contact or at the end of the day, I think 537 is going to be able to help out this process. I didn't introduce Chris Gilmore, County Council. He's here with me as well to be able to answer any additional questions you might have.
Okay. Questions from the committee? No? Okay. I see you have a dash one here, amendment, so can't move that until we have
understand.
A fiscal look at that. So, is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 537? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 537. And let's see here. We have a list of work session bills that we've all heard before. And I'm going to skip over the first one for the moment and go to Senate Bill. Well, we're going to stand at ease for a minute. We've lost our committee staff. Let's recess for 5 minutes. Start out with Senate Bill 674, so I'll open the work session on Senate Bill 674. Richard?
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 674 eliminates the requirement that the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services examine rating organizations at least once every 5 years. There's no revenue impact and no expenditure impact, and we had a public hearing on March 1st on this measure.
Okay, we're in work session. Is there...
Which bill?
We're on Senate Bill 674. We've heard it before. To move us along, the chair will move Senate Bill 674 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there objection or is there discussion? Is there objections? Seeing none, the Senate Bill 674 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair.
Carrier.
I think Senator Atkinson should do it. He should carry all these bills.
He did hear the bill, so we'll assign that one to Senator Atkinson.
Yeah, I like that.
Okay, let's move on down to Senate Bill. What? We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 195.
Senate Bill 195 repeals statutes relating to the Space Age Industrial Park. There's no revenue impact and no expenditure impact. We heard this bill on February 24th.
Okay, the chair would move Senate Bill 195 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? No discussion? Is there any opposition? There's no opposition. Senate Bill 195 is moved to the floor with a due pass with a unanimous recommendation. I think we'll let
Nelson.
Nelson.
Senator Nelson carry that bill.
We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 178. Richard.
Senate Bill 178 removes requirement for the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to compare state and federal prevailing wage and make results of comparison available. It requires public agencies to require that in contracts for public works, the contractor and subcontractor pay the hire of applicable state and federal prevailing wage. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact and minimal expenditure impact. We heard this measure on March 8th.
The chair would move Senate Bill 178 to the floor with a do pass discussion.
This isn't my favorite agency, and it's going to kill me to vote yes.
But all of your business friends have locked arms on this one.
I know.
any discussion? Is there any opposition? There is none. Senate Bill 178 is moved to the floor with the do pass recommendation. Senator Burdick, would you carry this?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm a little nervous because this is the day I missed. So
I'll carry it.
Hearing. Thank you.
The chair will carry the bill. Let's move to Senate Bill 384. Open a public work session on Senate Bill 384. And actually, I don't.
Senate Bill 384 revises the billing cycle in construction contracts from 30 days to monthly. It changes the statement requirement for alternative billing cycles and allows specification of alternative time limit for making final payment. It allows the prevailing party in disputes over interest to collect reasonable attorney's fees. There's no revenue impact, and we have not yet received a fiscal impact on the bill. There are also -1 amendments that were not available at the time of the public hearing, and we've not received fiscals or revenues on those. The original public hearing was on March 1st.
Okay. And we actually can't move this. So.
No, we can adopt the amendment if we would like, but we can't move the.
It's committee's pleasure. Should we go ahead and adopt the amendment or put it over and do it all at once?
You got the amendment.
And there is someone from
I don't see an amendment.
We have someone who wants to.
There is someone from the State Bar who wants to the amendment if we would like them to.
I'm trying to. I don't.
384-1.
There it is.
I don't think we have it.
We got it.
There it is. Stack.
Sorry.
In the stack of things.
It's not on my web though.
Here it is.
We now have it. So you want to tell us what we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Niebel with the Oregon State Bar. I'm appearing on behalf of the construction law section who proposed this bill. The amendments are requested by the proponents, and they're requested simply to correct a number of drafting errors and make a number of provisions parallel to provisions that already exist in the bill. And they're non-substantive in the nature of housekeeping amendments, and I would urge you to adopt them.
Okay.
I'm open to adopting the amendment, but we can't move the bill, I guess. Is that the deal?
Can't move the bill because we don't have a fiscal on the amendment.
Might as well adopt the amendment.
I just want to make this clear.
Senator Starr, move adoption of the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 384. Discussion. Senator Dreyer.
I just want to make this clear. This is the cleanup language for the cleanup language of the bill.
We're all about cleanups today, Senator.
I don't like fixing the work we've done before.
I want to make sure I got it right.
Is anybody, any objections to adopting the amendments? There is none. -1s are adopted. Okay, so we're now down to Senate Bill 534. So we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 534.
Senate Bill 534 requires that the independent appraisal of damage to a motor vehicle in cases of a dispute between an insurer and insured be conducted by a person who has been issued a vehicle appraiser certificate. There's no revenue impact and minimal expenditure impact. We've heard this bill on February 14th and March 3rd, and there is a -1 amendment that has no revenue impact and minimal expenditure impact.
Mr. Fuller, you want to explain the -1? I guess we won't do the -2s.
Mr.
Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Auto Appraisers of Oregon. Thank you for bringing this bill back. The Dash 1 amendments are amendments that we requested from the original bill. They add the word competent to the requirements for a appraiser. As you remember from the public hearing, our concern there is that some certified appraisers may not be competent to appraise certain type of specialty vehicles, so we wanted to make sure that they had experience in the particular type of vehicle that they were appraising. We also didn't want to get into an interstate fight with Washington, so we added language to the bill that would allow a appraiser who is certified in another state to do business in the state of Oregon as well. So that's what the Dash 1 amendments will do. There was an appraiser who appeared at the public hearing, requested some additional amendments on an unrelated issue, but still having to do with appraisers. And we looked at those amendments. The insurance companies who support the Dash 1 amendments indicated that they would oppose those additional amendments, which appear to have some technical problems because they refer to an administrative rule in the amendment. And my understanding is you can't refer to an administrative rule in a statute or a specific administrative rule. So we're going to continue to look at the issues that were brought up there, but would appreciate your support of the Dash 1 amendments on this bill. And we'll look at the other issues at another vehicle. Yeah, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions of Mr. Fuller. Chair moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 534. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? There's none. The Dash 1s are adopted. The Dash 2s, I'm told, have some technical difficulties, not quite doing what the gentleman who requested them, who's my constituent, asked for, so I think we'll allow those to be looked at separately. Chair moves Senate Bill 534 as amended with the Dash 1s to the floor with the due pass. Is there further discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none. Senate Bill 534 is amended, is moved to the floor with a due pass. Senator Starr, would you carry this one?
Certainly.
And that takes us to the end of our agenda. Is there any additional business before the committee today? There is none. We are adjourned.